So this one's called The Baby. The baby says to the old man, "Let's have a cup of coffee." The old man says, "Now you're talking."
Louisiana Literature sluttede sidste weekend, men lever videre her i Bogfolk, og så selvfølgelig i de optagelser, som Louisiana selv optog og som findes på nettet. Velkommen til din ugentlige podcast om litteratur. Mit navn er Jes Stein Pedersen, og i dag skal det handle om amerikanske Arlene Miles, som Bogfolk mødte på festivalen. Miles er romanforfatter, performer og ikke mindst poet. Med 20 udgivelser har hun længe haft kultstatus i sin hjemby New York, men hun har først blevet et etableret navn i den bredere litterære offentlighed for nylig. Så er hun også kendt som et lesbisk ikon med sit forfatterskab og sin politiske aktivisme, forsøger hun blandt andet at give en stemme til outsiderne. Hun medvirker i den meget populære Amazon-serie Transparent, hvor karakteren Leslie er bygget på Arlene Miles. Og den medvirken i Transparent har skabt debat i USA og rejst spørgsmål i forhold til netop kønsidentitet. Og i den forbindelse så har hun til det danske magasin Atlas udtalt følgende, og jeg citerer: "Rammerne for homoseksualitet, lesbianisme, queer, for det at identificere sig som mand eller kvinde, er ikke statiske. Man lever i de her kønnede rammer, og lidt ligesom med mode vender man sig til at være synlig og usynlig. Det er alt sammen sprog, der møder krop, hvilket er poesi. I en alder af 66 føler jeg ikke længere, at sproget kan indeholde mig. Derfor er jeg kønnet Arlene." Og med det siger Arlene Miles altså, at hun hverken vil kaldes mand eller kvinde. Så i den forstand skulle jeg ikke engang have kaldt hende hun eller hende i den tekst, jeg lige har læst op. Hun er Arlene. Netop nu er Arlene Miles aktuelt med Ikke mig, som er oversat af Mette Mostrup. Så velkommen til en samtale mellem Bogfolks udsendte Kisaya Rorte Mogensen og Miles. Den handler om poesi, teknologi og politik, om Instagram og min sanden også om den gang Miles stillede op til det amerikanske præsidentvalg.
An American poem. I was born in Boston in 1949. I never wanted this fact to be known. In fact, I spent the better half of my adult life trying to sweep my early years under the carpet and have a life that was clearly just mine and independent of the historic fate of my family. Can you imagine what it was like to be one of them? To be built like them, to talk like them, to have the benefits of being born into such a wealthy and powerful American family. I went to the best schools. I had all kinds of tutors and trainers, traveled widely, met the famous, the controversial, and the not-so-admirable. And I knew from a very early age that if there were ever any possibility of escaping the collective fate of this famous Boston family, I would take that route, and I have. I hopped out on Amtrak to New York in the early 70s, and I guess you could say my hidden years began. I thought, well, I'll be a poet. What could be more foolish and obscure? I became a lesbian. Every woman in my family looks like a dyke, but it's really stepping off the flag when you become one. Well, holding this ignominious pose, I have seen and I have learned, and I'm beginning to think there's no escaping history.
Jeg mødte Arlene Miles på Louisiana Literatures tredje dag og stillede hende som den aldeles grønne og urutinerede interviewer, jeg er, en masse spørgsmål i øst og vest. Samtalen bevæger sig fra at handle om digtsamlingen Ikke mig og tiden, den blev skrevet i og beskriver, til at handle om, hvordan Arlene Miles ser på den aktuelle politiske situation i USA og på den rolle, teknologi spiller i både Miles' poesi og vores liv. Samtalen begynder med, at jeg spørger ind til, hvad der rørte sig i amerikansk poesi på det tidspunkt, Miles skrev og udgav digtsamlingen.
I'm thinking we could talk a little bit about Not Me, which has just been released in Danish. It was originally published in 1991. What was American poetry like in 1991?
Good question. I mean, I think it was, in a way, what it always is, which is just a collision of forces. There's a mainstream poetry. There's a avant-garde poetry. Within that, there's different clusters of more severe, more playful, more feminist, more embodied, you know. Maybe, I mean, poetry is always striving in some way to be political, but I think that I feel like I was very much trying to enter that world in a kind of a lyric avant-garde political feminist way, you know, which was very and it was interesting for this book came, I mean, Semiotext had never published a book of poetry before. So what was very interesting was to be a poet who got to be published in this, you know, theory and
you know, it had just been innovated by Chris, who had started this line of native agents within the context, because before that it was almost entirely men doing theory, being imported into America. And then Chris initiated
Chris
this. Chris Krauss initiated this line of female eye-centric fiction writers, which included Kathy Acker and Cookie Mueller and herself. And then into that, I was the first and only poet who was. So what it did was a very wonderful thing, which was it sent my world to worlds that wouldn't necessarily have been penetrated by poetry. So that was very special.
The poem opens with the lines, I have a confession to make. I wish there was some role in society I could fulfill. I could be a confessor. And then later it also invites the you of the poem to confess. Mm-hmm. Tell someone, it says, not me, but tell someone.
Right.
It's a new human program to be in. So tell me, Eileen.
Yes.
Why would you want to be a confessor? And what does the not me point to? And what is this new human program?
Right, right. Well, notice I say I would like to tell someone, not me. So in a way, it's both wanting to be a confessor and not wanting to be a confessor, and maybe kind of inviting a kind of, I mean, in poetry, of course, there's such a thing as confessional poetry, which I would not want to be a part of, you know, and I'm not a part of. And we think of that as sort of personal but academic lyric poetry, which is not avant-garde. I mean, there's things that, like Sylvia Plath was considered part of that. I'm sure she wouldn't have felt she was part of that. But and there's poems that she wrote, like Daddy, that I love. But basically, I think there was an invitation for this kind of public murmuring of telling stories in a liberatory way. You know, but maybe not making one be special, you know, in a way, not me was an attempt to do something that was like anti-personal, you know, and to maybe say that there was a movie called The Invisible Man, and it the scientist took some chemical that made him be invisible, and then he became a criminal, of course. And so then in one scene in that movie, he ran out into the snow, and because of the snow, you could see the shape of the invisible man kind of moving through the, you know, the night trying to flee. And I think of Not Me as that way, in which I wanted to not be telling so much my story as to show the shape of my story moving through the world, you know. And I think when I was writing it, at that time in my life, a lot of things were changing radically. Some of the poetry was of a very young, drunken, druggy sort. And then some of the poetry was when that person abjured drunkenness and stopped drinking and changed. And also New York was changing because we suddenly, because of Reagan, we had a... he did this thing where he decided there were just too many people in mental hospitals, and there was an outpatient movement which suggested that they could all go to some clinic and talk as opposed to being inside of mental hospitals. But what it meant was that there was a lot of mentally ill people on the streets of New York, homeless, you know, and some of them were veterans. So it was a very intense moment where arts funding was cut and social services were cut. And so there was, I think there was, and it was at the height of the AIDS crisis, and late 80s. And gentrification was starting to hit my neighborhood for the first time too, though of course I was part of the earlier gentrification. So I felt like I was witnessing, and like the thing that was witnessing was changing chemically, and also the world that I was witnessing in was changing. And so I wanted to write a poetry that showed that path.
You also said something very interesting, I think, yesterday, which you could maybe also elaborate a little on now, namely that that not me, and this also, I think, connects to what you just said, is an account of being the landscape of changing time,
mm-hmm.
which was the mid-80s.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, when I say tell someone, not me, I think it's that. It's sort of like if I didn't become the receiver of all of it, then all those stories would just almost go into the world in a way, you know, and become the world.
Eileen Miles fortæller her om at ville skrive en antipersonlig poesi. Miles ville ikke bare bruge sine digte til at fortælle sin personlige historie, en historie som altså også er del af digtene, Men om man ville bruge sin digte og sin personlige historie til at bevidne de store historiske forandringer, man oplevede under Ronald Reagan i New York i slutningen af 80'erne. Og jeg spørger, om poesien er særligt egnet til den form for historieskrivning.
In your most recent novel, I think Inferno, a poet's novel, from 2010, which kind of uses Dante's Divine Comedy as a blueprint, you say that Dante really had no other way than to talk about his time except in a poem. And maybe this was not what you meant, and I know times have changed since Dante, but do you think that poetry is particularly well suited to chronicle its time?
Right now is different and special because we have social media. Everybody has access to many ways to document our time, and there's so much of that right now. But for a long time there wasn't that. And I think in a way, poetry always was the most immediate way to represent a moment. You know, it's sort of like any social moment, any social revolution, any new kind of people that we're hearing from, there's always a poet up front. And I think in some ways, I mean, like you're functioning in a way as a poet right here. It's sort of like being the mouthpiece of something. You know, it's sort of like when we say epic, there's like a character who's the hero. And in some ways that hero is just a poet. You know, it's sort of like nobody really knows who Aeneas is, but they know who Virgil is. And in some ways, Virgil is Aeneas. You know, it's sort of like he's being the hero, he's writing the hero, he's representing it. So I think a poet is always kind of that vocalist singing a song at the front of the story, you know.
Hermed er vi inde på, at poesi kan være politisk, og at politik ikke mindst er et tema i Miles' poesi. Jeg nævner, at ideen om litteraturen som en måde at give stemme, måske det hele taget er et tema på dette års Louisiana Literature. Og vi taler om, at det at stille op som præsidentkandidat for Miles også handlede om netop at give stemme og simpelthen videreformidle det, en masse mennesker fortalte hende om deres liv. Og så spørger jeg ind til hendes analyse af den politiske situation i USA lige nu.
Giving voice is really like almost a theme on this year's festival. Chris Krause, Edward Luiz, Svetlana Alexievich, all kind of uses literature to give voice or to make people who doesn't get to speak normally speak. Mm-hmm. Is this also like a part of your poetic project, like giving voice?
Yeah, well, I think in part of my collecting and gathering, like I live in this neighborhood where people, you know, I mean, not even as much today, but certainly when I was writing this book, it was just like there were just so many homeless people, so many panhandling people. You would know certain people who were always on that corner panhandling, you know, and it's like, and they would just populate the poems as much as Edward the Confessor, you know. So, and also I think, you know, I still believe the thing, which is that women somehow are anonymous. So even when I tell the precise details of an existence, which is mine, I think it's still in many ways an anonymous story, and because it so much resembles another female story, another queer person story, you know, another person from such and such an economic background, another person who's living this way, not at this economic level, but at this one, you know, that we don't hear about. You know, like when I remember when George, when during the presidential campaign of 1991 or 92, George Bush Sr. went into a supermarket and they picked up an item for the first time. And they picked up an item and there was a barcode on it. And he was like, "What's that?" And people realized that what being rich meant was that you never saw a barcode. You know, I mean, it's like rich people don't carry cash.
But really, and politics is clearly a theme in Not Me. Also, one of your most famous poems, an American poem, opens the book, in which you pretend to be a Kennedy or like, and you actually ran for president.
I did.
You did.
Yeah.
The same year as Not Me came out.
Yes, actually, yeah.
Against Bill Clinton.
Pardon me?
Against Bill Clinton.
Or? Well, kind of against Bush, and then also against Clinton. You know, once he got the nomination,
Why did you do that?
It was in a way to improvise politically in a public way. It was a way to, I mean, at 39, I was not a young poet, but to be a president, you need to be 39 years old in the United States. And so I was like a young, I remember when Kennedy was president when I was a kid, they were like, he was so young. And I mean, I knew he you know, because the president before that, Eisenhower had been bald and Kennedy had this brown hair. So he looked young in that way. But to me, as a, you know, as a 10-year-old, he was an old man. So how was he young? But so I realized I could flip that as a 39-year-old poet. I could be a young presidential candidate. And that was fun. But also to realize that I could run, that it was legal, that as a citizen, I had a right, you know, and that as a woman, as a queer person, as an artist, as a person who is making under $50,000 a year, there was nobody who was going to be representing my issues in the campaign, you know, and we would all be just, you know, having to listen on and on and on to this campaign for a year and a half. And so I thought if I entered it, I could just be part of that stream, part of that program of the presidential campaign. And I looked into it legally, and I found that to be a presidential candidate, you have to get so many signatures, like thousands and thousands and thousands of signatures. And so I would have to spend all my time getting those signatures. But there's something called a write-in campaign, which meant that you could just, like, there was a, I think it's still on the, in the voting box, there's like a little thing you lift. I mean, again, this is manual, so I don't know how this works on electronic voting, but it, like, there probably should still be a place where you could just literally write in a person's name. And most people write in Mickey Mouse, you know, there's like silly people who, you know, but this was part of our freedom of speech to be that candidate. And I thought, again, it seemed like poetry or writing to be that poem for people. It's like, no, I don't want George Bush. I don't want, you know, Bill Clinton. I want Lee Miles. So I thought, fine.
So what did it end with?
Well, it didn't so much end with anything as continue to be something. I mean, during that time, because what it meant was that I just gave many speeches. And as a citizen, it was before the internet. And so people were giving me information. People were giving me newsletters. People were saying, you should talk about this. You should talk about that. And they were just giving me so much information. And for the first time, I had something to do with it. You know, because before that, I would write about art. I would go into the gallery. I would stand. I would look at the art and then I would convey it. But now I would look at politics and I would let it go through my body and my system and I would convey it, whether in a poem or a speech or, you know. So I think the point of running for president was to run and to be part of that whole system of speech making. And also, you know, these guys weren't, maybe Bill Clinton to some extent was writing his speeches. George Bush was not writing his speeches. So I said that I would write my own speeches and I would tell you authentically what I was thinking, which I knew they were not doing, you know? So I felt like my campaign platform was total disclosure, which was to offer that kind of truth.
And while we are at it, why not ask you, do you have an analysis of the current political situation in you want to share? Is things getting worse, you know, with Trump as a president of the United States?
Right.
Or are there things that's getting better also or changing, you know? What's going on?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's truly both, because I don't think it's getting worse. I think it looks worse because now it looks like what it is. You know, I mean, I think that Trump represents something that is absolutely there. At 9/11, when people started to say, oh my God, we've never had terrorism on our soil. I mean, I went to an event that was largely Black and everybody in that room was laughing because no Black person in America who knows the history of lynching and slavery could say that there was never terrorism. Those white Klan members were terrorists, you know, just like those Nazis and, you know, Charlottesville were terrorists. And so I've been led deeper into American history too. There's a book by Howard Zinn called The People's History of the United States, which is, you know, everybody owns this book. It's about this thick, and it was even updated at some point, I think, in the aughts. And it just begins with the beginning, you know, and it just tells the story of American history, the story we don't get in school. And I've owned that book since the 80s. I just never read it, you know, and I read it once Trump got elected, and I was stunned. I mean, it was nothing I didn't know. I just knew it more widely. To what extent? I mean, like when we talk about, Trump talks about putting up a wall. You know, it's just like a wall against the people who we stole land from. You know, I mean, the best joke I think during the campaign was "Make America Mexico Again." You know, because America was Mexico up to Idaho, up to California. I mean, there was the Battle of Los Angeles in 1848. I never learned about that in American history. Like, we just took Los Angeles. It's like, it's so hard to understand the history of a country that has just, I mean, like, we exterminated Native Americans. We stole a whole population of slave labor. You know, I mean, like, it just never ceases. America's comma is pretty bad. And so I think that Trump is the spokesman for American history. And I think that if we feel something different, we just have to rise up and keep rising up in all the ways. I mean, I think the women's marches were amazing. And I think so that force is there. And so I think that it's like, when is that moment? I mean, it's kind of like, how bad does it have to get for us to all step out into the street and say, no, we won't, you know? I mean, like, I think people should stand at the US-Mexico border and say, no wall. Because I was fortunate enough to go to Palestine in May and see that wall. And it's insane. This is not a democracy. And we get all, you know, and then the United States is supporting Israel. But when I read this history that I mentioned, what I understood was that America's history and Israel's history are identical. You know, we just stole the land. It's just a land grab. A woman I'm currently having an affair with said, you know, you look like a Kennedy. I felt the blood rising in my cheeks. People have always laughed at my Boston accent, confusing lodge for lodge, party for party. But when this unsuspecting woman evoked for the first time my family name, I knew the jig was up. Yes, I am a Kennedy. My attempts to remain obscure have not served me well. Starting as a humble poet, I quickly climbed to the top of my profession, assuming a position of leadership and honor. It is right for a woman to call me out now. Yes, I am a Kennedy, and I await your orders. You, the new Americans, the homeless are wandering the streets of our nation's greatest city. Homeless men with AIDS are among them. Is that right? That there are no homes for the homeless? That there's no free medical help for these men? And women, that they get the message as they are dying that this is not their home. And how are your teeth today? Can you afford to fix them? How high is your rent? If art is the highest and most honest form of communication of our times, and the young artist is no longer able to move here to speak to her time. Yes, I could, but that was 15 years ago. And remember, as I must, I am a Kennedy.
There's a New York Times piece on you from last year, I think, that proposed that when you released your novel Chelsea Girls in 1994, I think, maybe the culture just wasn't ready for it. And naturally, I want to ask, are we ready not only for Chelsea Girls, but for all of your books and for you now, and why? I know you probably get this question all the time, yeah. but why do you think you get attention from the mainstream media now, and will you yourself ever be mainstream? Uh-huh. Or is this, as I suspect,
the mainstream? I think the mainstream kind of, it's like, if you're, it's like being tall, you know, you just sort of look for the other tall people, you know, and you don't see all the other people in the room. And I think that, you know, like the culture of poetry is complex and rich and changing, and we know each other to a very great extent. And I think just the happy accident, which, you know, I had something to do with. I met an editor at HarperCollins, and, you know, I was always convinced that the moment when I had a selected poems come out, like Chelsea Girls came out, got reissued because my selected poems were being issued, and then Chelsea Girls was like an add-on, you know, because the editor goes, so what else you got? And I said, Chelsea Girls. He goes, we'll do it. You know, and it was just kind of like somebody who had power who just decided like that we should publish this book. But my intention had always been that when I got to this moment, that it was like my, you know, like a visual artist has a retrospective, like here, Marina Abramović is having a retrospective here. And I think for poets, a retrospective is a selected poems. You know, we'll, it's a greatest hits. It says where you've been. And I just knew that when that moment came in my career, I wanted somebody big to do it. You know, so I had that confidence. And so I think that happened, you know. And so then, of course, what we get is the tall person saying, what's this little person doing here? And acting like, you know, like I was like some totally obscure person. But I think, as we know, it's like there are little rooms and big rooms, and the connection between the two rooms is culture. You know, I mean, that's what happens all the time. It's like somebody is like Madonna was a cult figure in the East Village in the 80s. Like, I saw her bartending at a place called Lucky Strike. And she was, you know, she was this girl from Detroit that all the punk bands laughed at, you know, and she rehearsed in the same building as them. And they were like, oh, God, look who's coming now, you know. And with the invention of MTV, with technology, suddenly this like kind of laughable, hot, kind of brave woman became global, you know? And so I think it's just like technology makes it happen, and I think accident makes it happen. But once you go from the little room to the big room, they have to contend with what you are and realize that there's not just one of you, there's many of you. So, I mean, I guess it's still quasi, you know, it's like there's a poster for this festival. My name's not on it. So I was like, you know, so am I big or am I not? Was I not one of the things that they were bragging about?
På dette tidspunkt i samtalen har Eileen Miles allerede været inde på, hvordan poesi og sociale medier har det til fælles, at de er en umiddelbar måde at repræsentere sin tid på. Jeg spørger ind til, hvilken rolle teknologi i det hele taget spiller i Miles' digte. I Ikke mig er det især telefonsvaren, der er en gennemgående figur. Og jeg spørger om, hvad det egentlig er, Eileen Miles har gang i på Instagram.
I'm really curious, so I just have to ask, what's your thing with Instagram?
Yeah.
Because you're a very active Instagrammer,
right.
and this is intended as a compliment, very like callous, have a callous style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Why
do
you like Instagram, or do you like Instagram?
Well, it's that thing of it gives you that opportunity to get over the strange loneliness of your existence in this world of technology. You know, like you're waking up and you pick up your phone and you don't realize the camera pot's on and it shows like your bare foot and an angle of the window. And it's just this view that I see by myself. And it's like, and I think that's a cool thing to shoot out to, you know, 500 people or 5,000 people or 20, however many people are following you, you know, so that there's a kind of an intimacy, sort of a beautiful, lonely, collective intimacy. I mean, it seems to me it's no different from poetry. And I think my Instagram is a lot like my poetry and it's sort of crooked collection. But I think it is this thing where I felt for a while, as soon as we had the internet, people started sharing their lists of where they eat, what they like, you know, and I think everybody's list is different. And so it's like Instagram gives me an opportunity to share my visual list. And also, you know, I just feel like, again, not just the mainstream is stunned, but this kind of weirdo homosexual poet is suddenly very public. I'm shocked. And so I'm in my bed in New York, and then I'm in Palestine, and then I'm in Denmark, you know, and then I'm like, you know, at the doctor's office, you know, and it's just like, I guess your life looks like that too in some way. And so I think it's like, there's just some place to register that and to touch it for a second and you know, it's the new human program to be in. It's like, not me, but everyone. It's like that place where we all live now. And the funniest part though, is that the night before I left the States, I got a text and somebody said, there's a band playing tonight in Brooklyn called Eileen Miles' Instagram.
Perfect.
And I was like, are they good? And they were like, they better be with that name. But
so, what do they play? What kind of music?
I know nothing. All I know is that they exist and they had a show. And it's not, I heard about them before too. And okay. I thought, it's only going to happen once, you know.
I'm going to go home and research on that.
I know, I ought to. I don't know why I haven't, yeah.
But I could, in fact, also ask you what, you know, technology in a broader sense and media mm-hmm. Means to you. Because when I read your books and listen to you now, I can't help but noticing how often you actually refer to different, often very time-bound technologies.
Right.
And TV plays quite mm-hmm. a big role in your poems. And yesterday in your reading, you commented on on one of the poems who had a letterpress in it. And there's some Xeroxing.
A word processor.
Okay, right. Yeah. And so there's Xeroxing and like these now old technologies. And you say that you actually write poems on your phone.
Uh-huh.
And this brand new poem you read yesterday was special in that you hadn't written it on your phone, but...
In a notebook. Which, I write plenty of poems in notebooks, too. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
But what do you think, you know, how is your poetry shaped by technology?
Utterly. Like a pencil or a pen is technology, mm-hmm. right? It's a notebook is technology. I mean, it's just like that cyborg manifesto, like how many years ago, 20 years ago? I mean, we're all cyborgs. To be a poet is a cyborg. You know, but then once you have all these other, you know, I mean, like, and I think, you know, if I look at the history of poetry, Emily Dickinson isn't, you know, putting a record on and just thinking, you know, I mean, like, but Frank O'Hara is, you know, he talks about being at a bar called the Five Spot the night Billie Holiday sang a song and going into the bathroom and it was called the Day That Lady Died, you know, and you know that if he wrote that poem in the 50s or the 60s, that was in the newspaper or gossip. You know, he got it through some technology, whether it was a group or it was in the paper. You know, he woke up, he went to the newsstand, and it was like Billie Holiday dies. And then he flashes back to that night of being in a bar and thinking, hearing her sing and swooning against the bathroom door, you know? And it's just like that, that just is such an explication of poetry and technology and a moment of memory, of hearing, of newspapers. I mean, I think, and so right away, and Emily Dickinson didn't do that. You know, she did something else. And so I think every poet, like O'Hara famously wrote an essay called Personism Manifesto, and he talks about how at some point he was about to write a poem to someone about someone, and then he realized he could just pick up the phone. And the thing that's weird is that he didn't. He thought that, but he didn't do that. But my argument is that as soon as he had that thought, poetry changed forever because it started to be more of a phone call, you know? And I think now it's like poetry might be more of a tweet or it might be more of a long caption for an Instagram picture that is there or not there, you know? So it's always, I think it's, poetry always is an evocation of technology. War is technology, you know?
But it's also like an element to embrace that technology.
I think to let it be that many more platforms that we're writing or that we're making be part of our what's the word? Why can't I think? It's not metaphor. Yeah, technology is a metaphor. I mean, even, you know, speech. I feel like speech is my metaphor. All my novels are just like copies of speech in a way. It's sort of like acting as if this person is talking to you, acting as if this person is close. And I learned that from Gertrude Stein. You know, you read her talks and it's just like a recording of a woman talking, saying, I'm a genius. You know, I was like, that's great, you know.
This makes me think also about, I think in Inferno, the novel mm-hmm. I referred to earlier, there's so many great one-liners about poetry mm-hmm. also. It's just stuff with it. Like, one goes like this. A poet is a person with a very short attention span who actually decides to study it.
Huh.
This just, you know, like social media maybe also has to do something with attention span. And mm-hmm. so there, can you elaborate on what you meant when you said this?
Well, I think social media has become a huge purveyor of poetry because it's sort of like it uses that short attention span that everybody has and you can fill it with anything you want. It can be like a political statement. It can be an invitation to an event or it could just be a line of poetry. You know, it's sort of like, I think we are increasingly, you know, as soon as we became part of the generation, we're just lying on your bed with the remote going click, 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 click. And you're just choppy, 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 choppy. And then the phone rings, you're like, I don't think I'll get that. And then you click and you're like, I'll call you back, you know, and then the bell rings and somebody's delivering something. And it's like, we're living in all these different times. And it's like, how do we be animal? How do we be human in all that? You know, so I think it's sort of like, I think social media is allowing us to kind of share that sense of fragmentation with
of being. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're kind of like, here is our, you know, or to refuse it. You know, I mean, I think that's, I mean, like, that's this amazing experience I had the other night where I suddenly, my computer was broken. My phone wouldn't charge. I had nothing, you know, and then I slept all day and then was awake all night by myself in my room, you know, with nothing. And it was just like, the wholeness of it was like, because, yeah. I mean, part of the reason I mentioned answering machines in the 80s in my work was because nothing was ever the same again. You know, I used to live in my apartment with a telephone, and sometimes I would unplug it. And it was just like, if my friends wanted to see me, there were certain friends who I was close enough, they would buzz, you know, they would just buzz the buzzer, you know? And it's just like, we knew things. We would like, we had friends, like there was this married couple, Ted Berrigan and Alice Notley, who were poets, and their house was the house that all the young poets would go to. And they always were broke. So their phone would be turned off all the time. It wouldn't, you know, it wasn't, they just didn't pay the bill. So they didn't have a phone, you know, they had a phone, but it didn't work. And so if you were friends, you would just buzz up. But then the word of mouth would be, they're having a fight this week, they won't buzz you in, you know? And it was just that, you know, it was that simple. And time was different, you know? So I think when I was in this hotel room in Edinburgh, it was amazing to be in this. And every place I looked, I would look up and every single person around me was on the phone. You know, I just felt like some kind of witnessing animal, you know? Mm-hmm. So I thought, what would it be like to have a year without? I'll write a book called A Year Without and just have nothing, you know? Yeah. And like, but these are my dreams.
But isn't there also like a potential in, for example, the internet?
A potential
for good things, for like...
To be without?
Or to be with? No, to be with, I think. Yes.
Because I think the great question of the moment now, like, is it worse or is it better? Mm. You know, is there more, are more Black people being shot in America by cops? Or do we have the opportunity to learn how many lynchings are still happening? You know, I think it's the latter, you know, but it's sort of like still as a feeling animal, how do you take in all that pain? This nation's greatest city is home of the businessman, home of the rich artist, people with beautiful teeth who are not on the streets. What should we do about this dilemma? Listen, I have been educated. I have learned about Western civilization. Do you know what the message of Western civilization is? I am alone. Am I alone tonight? I don't think so. Am I the only one with bleeding gums tonight? Am I the only homosexual in this room? Am I the only one whose friends have died and are dying now? My art can't be supported until it is gigantic, bigger than everyone else's, confirming the audience's feeling that they are alone. That they alone are good, deserve to buy the tickets to see this art, are working, are healthy, should survive, and are normal. Are you normal tonight? Everyone here, we all normal? It is not normal for me to be a candidate, but I am no longer ashamed, no longer alone. I'm not alone tonight because we are all candidates, and I am your president.
Sådan sluttede min samtale med Eileen Miles på Louisiana Literature. Og sådan viste det sig, at de forskellige emner, vi kom omkring, måske alligevel havde noget til fælles. Ideen om, at poesien kan være en måde at bevidne en historie, der ellers ikke bliver bevidnet. En måde at give stemme til nogen, der ellers ikke har en stemme. En måde, kort sagt, at give ensomheden modstand, at lette den universelle byrde, det netop er at være alene med sig selv.
Det var alt for denne gang. Vi er tilbage næste uge. Husk at anbefale programmet til venner og bekendte, til litteraturinteresserede i almindelighed. Vi findes i iTunes, og du kan også finde os i App Store, hvis du downloader Politikens podcast-app, og så er vi altid at finde på pol.dk under podcast. På genlyt.